Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The brain, language, and civilization, from developmental perspectives, both in children and in adults, as a whole, are the things that have separated our species from the rest of the animal kingdom. Dr. Sherwin Newland, a retired professor of medicine at the Yale Medical School, is an author of many books, including The Wisdom of the Body. In this program, originally broadcast in May of 1997, we began when I asked Dr. Newland, what is it about our species that has allowed us to learn so much about ourselves?
It's the brain. It's all the brain. Our brain, as you know, is significantly larger and better developed than our closest animal relative, the chimpanzee. It's almost as though we had accomplished 100 million years of evolution with this one great leap.
The development of language is what crystallizes it?
Language is the essential thing. What actually happened was primitive Homo sapiens gave rise to modern Homo sapiens about 40,000 years ago, and what made it modern Homo sapiens was the development of certain muscles around the voice box and the increase in size of the frontal part of the brain that allowed not just the creation of the appropriate sounds, but the reception, the understanding, the integration of all of the messages that were coming in. So once that begins, culture, speech, develops geometrically because we are now receiving things, assimilating them, sorting them out, and responding to them. So it isn't just a question of new sounds being made, but new sounds being made based on the new information that is always coming in. That's the crucial time.
When the voice box muscles developed and the brain became larger is the crucial time of the change.
That's the crucial time. Somewhere between 25 and 40,000 years ago, and you can see it in the development of the bones in the front of the skull, that they became straighter because more room was needed for this frontal part of the brain and also the voice box.
And that would, just from a Darwinian perspective, be by chance.
Well, mutations occur,
mutations,
and those mutations that are able to survive begin to dominate the fields. And so they become the powerful group. They can reproduce more and more. And here we are. It's the basic principle of what Darwin began calling natural selection.
And then the other change, that possibly the one that you were referring to, is when new information comes in, sounds are determined to be words, that develops with the infant from the learning of language.
Yes, which introduces another factor, which is, of course, that our heads are much too big to get out of the pelvis, so our babies are born when they are still totally unable to take care of themselves. There's a very prolonged period of childhood development during which the entire culture, this culture that has been built up over 25,000 years, is transmitted to a child. If the child were born at such a time that he could fend for himself, there would be no opportunity to transmit the values of the society.
Are there other species where that actually happens? In the gorillas and the chimpanzees, is the child that unable to take care of itself for as long? Obviously not as long.
Yeah, we have primate relatives in which there is a period of dependency, but it's nothing like our period of dependency. And the amount of the cultural experience, of course, obviously is not as great. Mankind stands up straight, which has resulted in a narrower pelvis than a baboon or a chimpanzee. So we've got a double problem. One is the head is so big, and the other is that the pelvis is so narrow. So this child has to come out much earlier than a chimpanzee might, for example. And that adds another factor on top of it, which is that the human being requires help at the time of delivery. Now, this has been made much of by some anthropologists who say this is the child's first first contact with socialization, the child on some level understands that there's someone there other than mama. And this may be the beginning of our consciousness of a society.
You make reference in the early part of your book to countless past moments, thought and unthought, conscious and unconscious. How does the unthought and the unconscious fit into molding us?
The new theories of neuroscience are increasingly telling us that memories, images, do not come to us in one piece. They exist in many different parts of the mind or the brain, and they come together. If you can retrieve one part of an image, the rest of the image will come together.
For example?
For example, my looking at your face. I will leave here, and I will remember what you looked like. Now, it'll seem to my conscious mind that that's a single Vogel image. The fact is that there are probably 1,000 bits of Vogel's face that I have in my brain in different places. And all I've got to do is remember your right eye, and everything else will start coming in until I see it all. Now, the conscious mind, as I say, sees it as one. But the brain is actually bringing all this stuff together. Now, this is how memory exists, too, that there are many different parts of an individual memory coming together into consciousness. And the circuits reverberate back and forth. They strengthen each other. They weaken each other. They're additive. They're subtractive. There's a whole maelstrom of messages going back and forth to bring a single full message into consciousness. So things are preserved at different levels in the brain, and for consciousness to actually happen involves taking these submerged things and bringing them up. So there's always a lot of submerged, and I take advantage of that in my own writing. And if you'll allow me to tell you this story.
Please.
I write from my subconscious. I never plan anything. I make no outline. Every morning, I sit down with my number two Eberhard Faber pencil, and I let the pencil write what I want to write. Some days, I'll read what I wrote the day before, but usually, I don't even do that. The interesting thing about this is I've now written 3 trade books. Every single book has had a natural beginning, a middle, and an end. Certain themes have emerged without my thinking about them, just simply because I trust how much information is somewhere there in my brain waiting to come out. And I'd like to convince everybody that we all have this ability, and we ought to trust it a little more.
How do you convince people to do that? You're obviously in a position to do that, teaching history of medicine, teaching clinical surgery. What do you say to
that? It's an impossibility. It's an impossibility in a medical school because the very curriculum of a medical school is so structured, is so rigid and conservative that there's very little room for this kind of emotional, mental, intellectual roaming around. We are so busy cloning young people to be exactly like ourselves that we take originality out of them, and I suspect that the young person of today who gets into medical school is the most conforming young person in his or her class in college. It seems to me that pre-medical students learn to know what we expect of them, and they give it to us.
What brought you out of this mold?
Well, I've always been very proud of being an oddball. I shouldn't say always. It's no good to be an oddball when you're an adolescent. When you get into your 20s, you start glorifying it and feeling that it's the most wonderful thing that you've been out of the traces. I come from a family quite different than most of the families that I grew up close to. Certainly a family very different from the kinds of friends I made in college and medical school. So I've always thought of myself not just as an outsider, but as an outsider who was very curious about what mainstream people did and spent almost all of my life studying mainstream people while always being a little bit outside. Now, most writers feel they're outsiders. That's supposed to be the secret of writing. But they tend to be abstracted from the major group. I always felt I had to get into the center of the major group and study it.
What was your early childhood like?
Well, I was born of immigrant parents. My brother and I were the only members of our family who could read or write English. We spoke Yiddish in the home. I learned English as a second language, and the result of it was that I developed the sense that this was the most valuable thing. The English language was the secret to me of getting out of what I saw in the 30s and 40s as an atmosphere that did not provide me the kind of stimulation that I thought would help me grow. I always had the sense that I'm going to get out of this, and the secret of it is language. So I developed what I can only call an adoration of the English language. The irony of it is that I've met other people very much like myself, with a background not too different from mine, who've become literary critics, in the sense keepers of the English language. Harold Bloom, perhaps the greatest of American literary critics, went to my high school. So
in the Bronx,
right. And who's a greater keeper of the English language and the English literary tradition than Harold Bloom?
At a time when immigrant parents encourage their children into the mainstream, what sort of support or resistance did you get from your parents that focused the, to use your words, the oddball characterization or the outsider characterization?
It's an interesting question because there was nothing overt. Everything was assumed. From earliest childhood, I knew that my parents assumed that I would become the master of this culture for them. It was as though their generation felt there was nothing they could accomplish, and it was going to be accomplished by their children. And so the assumption was always there that I was going to go to a university, I was going to do some professional thing. My grandmother, who couldn't speak a word of English, used to talk to me about this occupation that she would call diplomieren, which is public speaking. And she was sure that this little boy, who was 4 or 5 years old, would grow up to do public speaking. And lo and behold, she was right.
Here we are.
Yeah. How more public can you be than on radio?
That's right. I'd like to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Dr. Sherwin Newland, a professor of the history of medicine and surgery at Yale University Medical School, and the author of a new book entitled Wisdom of the Body. You're listening to Radio Curious, interviews with those we wonder about. I'm Barry Vogel. I'd like to ask you about what occurred in the past few hundred years that brought together all of this knowledge that we have about our bodies, the control, the ability to control electricity, the ability to go to the moon.
Well, since we're using a timeline of several hundred years, you have to put your finger on the Enlightenment, the early 18th century, when some of the intellectuals, thinkers, and philosophers began to recognize that if progress is to be made, including cultural progress, certainly scientific progress, one had to separate oneself from the sense that God did everything. In fact, some of those Enlightenment philosophers were among our first agnostics and atheists, of course. Some of them were religious people, but their idea was that if you're going to find out how nature really functions, you must at least make believe there's no God. Look for natural laws. Try to find out what makes the universe work with a view toward controlling it. And that's always been the secret of science, to break things down into their smallest particles, study them free of any entanglements, the whole approach being oriented toward controlling nature so that we can become independent of it. And look how we have succeeded. Man is almost independent of his natural surroundings to the point where probably, except for minor evolutionary changes, we are the way we are going to be. We don't need to change, to evolve in order to escape terrible rains and storms. We don't need to evolve to change our susceptibility to awful temperature drops, for example, because we become independent of that. So the likelihood of significant mutations and changes, except to fight certain infectious diseases, that likelihood is very small. We will probably remain as we are. So the real evolution that's going to occur will be cultural evolution, the evolution in which we use the brain we already have to create change, progress, and transmit that to our children.
What do you see as the manifestation of that change?
Well, first, let me say that the reason I am very optimistic about cultural evolution is that I think we have much more cerebral brain capacity than we are using at the present time. First place, we know that the brain has what we call plasticity, the ability to change, the ability to absorb new kinds of information, to synthesize new kinds of information. But I actually believe that we have more brain tissue than we have used. And I base that on the fact that every other organ in the body is characterized by excess tissue. We can do perfectly well with one lung, and many people do after surgery. We can do perfectly well with 10 feet of intestine instead of 21. We can do well with one half of one kidney. It stands to reason to me that we've also got a lot more cerebral, organic material than we have been using. I think the future will be the use, increasing use of that organic material and the increasing recognition of how we can make our brains change over time. So I'm optimistic that several things will happen. I think people disagree with me when I say this, but I think we are much more civilized than we have been. We've had a Holocaust, we've had Bosnia, we've had Cambodia, but the fact of the matter is that individuals in the late 20th century are much more civil to each other between races, between social classes, than they were 100 years ago, and certainly more than they were 500 years ago. We have recognition of other groups in our society that we never had before. There is much less xenophobia than there was before. So I'm optimistic about the gradual cultural changes, moral improvement that will go on. I think we will continue to kill large numbers of each other under certain circumstances, but I think the general trend of daily discourse, of civility, will improve. So that's one of my predictions. Another of my predictions has to do with science. Until very lately, there has never been any need or reason to inhibit any scientist from following his and now her curiosity. We are now entering a phase of physical science, certainly biomedical science, where the implications of what is being done have to do with ethics, have to do with wide societal changes. And I find myself wondering if we can still afford to let the scientists not study everything they want to, but apply everything they want to. Does the mere fact that we can do something mean any longer that we should do it?
Genetic engineering.
Genetic engineering is obviously the first thing that would, yes, that would come to mind. That we shouldn't do it just because we can.
Where do we draw the line? Saying that we will not tread or we will not experiment into a given area.
Well, there is no line, and there is no right policy.
But there's a given area that offends some people and not others.
But this has to be the consensus of society. We have never asked for the consensus of society in the form of ordinary people, in the form of government, in the form of ethicists. We have just assumed that what can be done should be done.
Consensus in terms of everyone agreeing or a majority?
Neither everyone agreeing nor a majority. Let me tell you what I mean. My wife is a Quaker. Quakers, when they have a decision to make, all get together. They don't vote. Majority has nothing to do with it. But the leader of the group listens carefully to what everybody says and begins to realize that something is evolving that he calls, quote, the sense of the meeting. The sense of the meeting becomes, we should go in this direction. Now, this allows for some people who say, no, 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 that's 180 degrees wrong. It allows for some people who would like to get there even faster than they're going, but essentially, it brings together under the best possible consensus what the group would like to do. I'm a big believer in common law. I approach the whole euthanasia and assisted suicide question as a question not of real law, but of common law. That there has to emerge in our society a consensus of what the society will put up with, what the society finds very offensive, so that there are these shadings out in the periphery and gradually toward the center, there is a coming together about what the right thing to do is. It has to be that way in such a pluralistic society. There's never going to be any way we know what's right and what's wrong.
That's the concept of democracy, to a great extent. Have the bell curve with occasional fringes tugging and pulling on either side.
Except that doesn't the concept of democracy also almost demand a vote, almost demand that the majority...
Well, that's how the consensus is arrived at the polling place. But still, there are plenty of people, I believe, in our society who don't vote, but militate for their belief.
Yes, when there is a black or white solution, some of these solutions have no yes or no. I mean, doctor-assisted suicide has no yes or no. So one has to gauge, because of a lot of public discourse, what the public finds completely unacceptable, what they find acceptable, and where the center is. And from that can come some kind of common law that actually may be different in different states. I don't know. But that's the only way we're going to solve these problems, and not by going to the Supreme Court.
I agree. I agree with that, sure. The third point?
The third point. My gosh, I've talked so much I forgot what the third point was. We were talking about science.
Well, the people will treat each other better.
Oh, yeah.
And the science will improve.
Yeah, and the science will improve. And the third point is actually a corollary of the first point. I think that there will be, on high levels like government, and then on lower levels of individual people, a greater sense of the necessity to care for each other. More perhaps out of enlightened self-interest than anything else. The increasing realization in the last 25 years that this Earth really is like a spaceship on which we're all stuck. That internationalism is so important to the economy, to health, to science, that unless we take care of each other and bring the poorest elements of civilization closer to the richest elements of civilization, we are stuck. We're going to continue to have economic slowdowns, recessions, wars. So it's a matter, once again, of self-interest that drives the entire machinery.
But if the population of the world continues to increase so radically, there's not going to be a lot of room for us. And you mentioned earlier in our discussion that we may continue to kill our species off in great numbers.
Well, here's some pie in the sky. With increasing international cooperation comes increasing understanding that what is good for one nation is probably going to be good for many other nations. Here's the example that I like best of all, pollution in China. China is the most polluted country in the world for a bunch of reasons, one of which is that they've been burning soft coal forever and they just don't give a hoot. The Chinese, as we become closer, which I think is inevitable, perhaps we'll have 10 years of really big problems, but inevitably we will become closer, will come to realize that their threat to world pollution is as much a threat to them as it is to the rest of the world, and they will have to do something about it. Now, they've done something about their population, Other countries have perhaps been less successful. But this whole notion of enlightened self-interest appeals to me enormously when it comes to countries dealing with each other. Whether it'll be through the United Nations, whether it'll just be through absolute necessity, I don't know, but I think it'll come to pass.
I want to ask about something you mentioned earlier in terms of the evolution of our species. With medical science being able to keep people alive who would otherwise die off, they're here to procreate. The less fit are now able to survive, whereas before medical science as it is now, they would not.
You know, I have less faith in the ability of medical science to increase longevity than I do in public health measures. The reason that we are living to our 70s, whereas 75 years ago we lived into our 50s, let's say, really has to do with things like immunizations, like purification of the water supply, like the realization that we really have to exercise for our hearts, we really have to stop smoking. There have been no massive changes in longevity due to medicine. Medicine, by very nature, is aimed at individual people and not large population groups. So what I think is going to happen is that the general level of health will increase, and it will not be a matter of the weakest continuing to survive, but a gradual increase in the general salubriousness, if you can use such a word, of everybody.
The natural selection of people who die because of bad diarrhea and intestinal diseases will be narrower.
Exactly, yeah. And it's already happening. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Newland, I want to thank you for joining us at Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests at the end of an interview. And that is, could you please tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
This will surprise you, because I think probably none of your readers will be interested in such a book. I discovered it by accident, and I just finished reading it the other day. It's called The Meaning of Yiddish. It's written by Binyamin Harshav, Harshav, who is a professor of comparative literature at Yale. And it is the first description I have ever seen of the evolution and origins of the Yiddish language and its importance in European culture, not just Jewish culture. It's a remarkable book, beautifully written. Unfortunately, it costs too much money because it's a university press and they charge $45 for a 200-page book. But it's an excellent book that I highly recommend to everybody.
Well, Dr. Sherwin Newland, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherwin Newland, a retired professor of medical history and medicine at the Yale University Medical School, is the author of The Wisdom of the Body. The book that he recommends is The Meaning of Yiddish by Benjamin Harshav. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.